episode 12 of Taekwon Don't the Shame Chronicles. I'm your host, Kyle.
And I'm Melanie.
And I'm Josh.
Sorry.
We're doing things a little bit differently this week for the audience at home. Melanie and Josh will, for the first time, be hearing all of the audio as it happens instead of me editing in later. So I don't know if that's what they were laughing about or not.
No, I was laughing about my super awkward intro, and I'm Melanie.
Oh, well, I think that's probably the part of the show that we need to improve on the most, and it's not just you. So basically, I just try to get through it as quickly as possible, and so that we can get on to the real meat of the show.
Sure.
So, awkward transitioning to the meat of the show. So today is Earth Day. We're recording this on Sunday, April the 22nd. So have you guys done anything for Earth Day today?
No.
And our previous attempt at recording, I believe you mentioned that you celebrated it the same way you celebrated St. Patrick's Day, which is to say you did not drink today.
Correct. I did get bit by a mosquito. That's earthy.
Yeah.
did you
kill it?
No, it flew away.
Oh.
I would have killed it if I'd been able to.
Yeah, there are a lot of little critters that I, you know, feel some amount of, I guess, empathy toward. And if they're in the house, I'll just try to get them out of the house.
Uh-huh.
But I think all mosquitoes should probably be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. That was actually one of the... Well, this is a weird tangent to this, but when Lauren and I went to Europe for the first time, I wasn't quite sure what to expect as far as the local fauna was concerned, specifically the insects. I was worried that maybe there was going to be like a completely different set of insects, because that's not something that anyone ever talks to you about when
right.
you go abroad. And it turns out that for the most part, it's the same insects. I'm assuming because of... the sort of non-strict standards of transporting livestock or vegetables and fruits across continents, that for the most part, we have the same insects that Europe does.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that I found the most annoying is the mosquitoes there are really persistent and are able to get inside of the hotels and stuff pretty easily. And I'm not normally the kind of person that sleeps like under the sheets, like my head under the sheets or the covers or anything. But that was pretty much the only way that I could sleep there. Because it was literally like the mosquito, well, first of all, there's no air conditioning or anything, so there's no like background noise at all. It's complete
really?
Silence. And you hear the mosquito flying towards your face from about 10 feet away. And it just like that buzzing sound getting louder and louder and louder until it's like right next to you. And then I don't know, maybe I just had a problem with this and Lauren didn't, but I remember a couple times just like wildly thrashing about in the bed, like trying to blindly slap this mosquito, which I never did. And so finally I guess she didn't have a problem with it because she normally sleeps under the sheets. So it wasn't really bothering her. But yeah, towards the end of it, I almost had to sort of swaddle myself from head to toe in the sheets in the comforter to get away from their mosquitoes. So
yeah, it was kind of terrible.
Yeah.
And when they get close to your ear, it's like such a high-pitched buzzing.
Yeah, and so that was the thing that was throwing me off is... I could hear them, because there was no ambient noises, I could hear them from much further away than I'm used to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be, like, thinking that it's practically in my ear. And
yeah.
I wouldn't, like, slap the side of my face or anything, but I would, like, you know how, you'll sort of like reach out with your open hand and try to like smash it, like close it together, like close your hand around it or whatever. Right. I'm doing that like next to my face all night. And I came to learn later when the lights were on that the mosquito was really like 2 or 3 feet away from me.
I got stung by a bee in Europe.
Really? Was it a European honeybee?
Yeah, it was a little Italian honeybee. And it wasn't any more charming than when you get stung by a bee in the United States.
Have you been stung by a bee in the United States?
Yeah, I've been stung by a bee once in high school.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, you weren't there. You were in college. It was my senior year.
It was a California bee.
It was a California bee. I got stung by a bee during a water polo game.
For whatever reason, bees and like wasps and hornets really like pools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's Earth
Day.
This is the day where we talk about all of nature's insects that we hate. So I guess you guys don't have any other plans for Earth Day today. You're not like planting a tree or anything.
No, it's way too hot outside to even do anything anyway.
So. Well, we didn't do this on our own, but our landlords finally came out to our house. We have we had that bush like right by the front door, the one that probably when you were here it looked pretty dead, I'm assuming.
I vaguely remember a big dead bush.
Yeah, yeah. And it like stuck out into the sidewalk. And we called it a rape bush because it was big enough that it created like this creepy corner in the side of our house where it seemed like that would be the kind of thing that would happen there. And then just finally the other day they said they were going to come by and take it out. And then when they were actually removing it, we left to go see a movie, I think. And when we came back, there was this tiny little bush planted in its place.
Like, it was so small.
It was like less than a foot high.
It looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's better than having a rape bush, right?
I think so. Yeah. So that's, we didn't actually plant anything, but something was planted on our property, so.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not really doing anything for Earth Day either. I can't promise I won't drink anything. I may have a beer later. maybe this isn't really something that you normally do on Earth Day. I mowed the lawn today. So I don't know how that will help the environment or not, but it makes the house look a lot nicer. that's probably something that's anti-Earth Day, right? Mowing the lawn?
Well, yeah.
Probably like any yard work that you do. Probably the worst thing you could possibly do is water your lawn. And I've been doing a pretty good job of not watering the lawn, so.
Yes, today I'm not watering anything. So.
You're helping the earth by propagating the human species.
That's true.
This is something that you planned out like 5 months ago.
Because you know we need more people.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it might actually be anti-Earth.
Yeah, if there's anything the Earth needs, it's more people. So, okay, but that's... I don't know why we started talking about Earth Day. I don't know why I brought that up.
I was going to say, yeah, you brought it up.
Yeah, so, sorry. We'll bring back the apology segment where I apologize for bringing up Earth Day and not really having anything to talk about other than European mosquitoes. All right, so... I guess I'll take the opportunity here to play some transition music, and then I'll edit this part out later. Or maybe not. Okay. This is going to make a lot more sense after we talk about how I probably shouldn't have brought up Earth Day. Okay, so welcome back to the, after that break. All right,
so
there
this
was
is what it's like to do a live show. Is that right?
Yeah, apparently we're gonna need a little more practice before we ever do this live. Guys, I really only had one thing I wanted to talk about. Well, maybe two things I wanted to talk about today, but only one thing that I have any real research or any time that I've spent thinking about it, and that is the subject of learning and teaching. And I figured that since you guys are both teachers and also both students, that maybe we could have a I don't know, somewhat intelligent conversation about this. But I guess the reason why I've been thinking about this lately, and by lately I mean over like the past 2 or 3 years, is because I've been doing a lot of stuff in sort of the artificial intelligence space in computer science, which is to say that I don't really know a whole lot, and also computer science doesn't really know a whole lot. And the sort of crossover into, like real science about how humans learn, hasn't been very helpful so far because of the sort of the differences in hardware between humans and, machines.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been thinking about, been thinking a lot about this lately from a non-computer perspective, and that is sort of, the fundamental things that help people to learn. And I think I've settled on one thing as being the most important concept that humans have for sort of sharing information with each other. And that is the metaphor.
Yep.
So, I don't know if you guys probably took sociology classes in your undergrad studies, right?
I took one.
One. So,
yeah, I think I took the one.
Well, I think this is like sociology 101 stuff anyway, but are you guys familiar with the concept of like not really having any individuality, that your individuality comes from sort of a sum of your interactions and learned behaviors from interacting with other people, society as a whole?
Yeah.
You don't really have any new or unique ideas inside you. You're just sort of taking things in and maybe interpreting them in a slightly different way because your brain is slightly different than everyone else's.
Mm-hmm.
But that your idea that you think is unique isn't really your own. Even if it is unique, it didn't start as your own. So my thought, or I thought about why humans are able to learn and teach each other effectively, and I thought about what helps me to learn effectively, and I really settled on this idea of the metaphor, or the example, if you want to get a little less abstract about it.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much anything that we learn in school, when you learn a new concept or learn about a new concept, the teacher sort of provides an example of something that you're already familiar with, and then changes that slightly for whatever the new concept is. So I was just curious what you guys thought about sort of the methods of learning and the methods of teaching.
Well, I think the metaphor is important. I know that one of the biggest challenges that I have teaching from a textbook, which is usually sort of like, these are the fundamentals of composition, or these are the fundamentals of rhetoric, or whatever. The challenging part is, so I'll assign that reading, which is usually pretty dry and straightforward, and then in order to know if my students understood it, then I have to think of examples that ask them to demonstrate those skills. So I don't think you can... I mean, like, some people could memorize the fundamentals, but they wouldn't be able to actually put them into practice. And it's only in specific examples or specific instances where you can actually put those things into practice. So I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and we were actually talking about this the other day. I think we were talking about math and the separation between when, like, the teacher shows you the concept and they work through some problems with you, and then there's the gap between that and the actual homework that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Which Melanie was saying, it seems like that is often a really large gap. And I've noticed that with, I'm taking some of those classes, from Udacity, which is like they're doing free programming classes.
Uh-huh.
And, on the forums, a lot of time, it seems like a common complaint is they have like quizzes as you go through the lectures, the videos, and then they have homework problems. And people are saying, these homework problems are way too hard compared to the quizzes. And the problem is that the people aren't taking the concepts and then seeing how they can apply that to the homework to solve the problem. And so I think that's, I would say that falls into the example idea, like taking the abstract idea and then how does that actually work out to solve a problem or whatever. And I think that's important.
Right. That was something else that I was thinking about, because when normally the first step in teaching a new concept is you teach the example, but what you're really trying to teach, I mean, you're trying to teach the concept, right, so that you can sort of use that knowledge and apply it to some other example or some other situation, right? But it's the same sort of concept that links the two together. So this sort of, I guess I'd call it like an abstraction. The abstraction of the concept is the important part, or is the part that once you learn that, then you pretty much have you have the fundamental knowledge of the concept.
Right.
And I see that there's a lot of that in, computer science particularly. There's even like one of the fundamental concepts of object-oriented programming is called abstraction, there's a lot of things. There's things called like design patterns, and it's sort of like templates for solving certain types of problems. Those are all sort of abstracted ideas. I was thinking about sort of the intelligence or the relative intelligence between animals. In humans, or humans and other animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think if we're actually that much more intelligent, or if it's just this one extra sort of level of figuring out metaphors and understanding abstractions that, and our ability to teach each other these things that actually makes us so much smarter or so much more advanced. And I think part of that has to do with our ability to create physical objects as well, like paper or tablets or whatever it is, to sort of record things, record ideas, and allow them to be shared more easily. And obviously our language as well. I guess that would have been first. I was remembering there's a scene in, I think it was one of those Animal Planet documentaries, like Planet Earth or something, where there's a scene where there are these monkeys that they have learned, or some of the monkeys have learned how to open these hard nuts by basically putting them on a hard surface and then smashing them with a particular kind of rock to get to the meat of the nut inside. And the younger monkeys can't directly, like, look at the older monkeys who have figured it out and then just naturally sort of say, oh, it's this particular type of rock on this particular type of surface with this amount of effort to swing the rock down or whatever. The only way that they can learn it is sort of by trial and error until one day they finally do it. And then once they finally do it, then they have learned the behavior. but they weren't really taught that behavior. They were taught, these are the types of tools that I can use, but nobody can tell them what the actual tool is or what the actual technique is.
Sure,
But if you look at sort of more intelligent species, like orangutans or gorillas, humans are able to teach these apes like sign language or simple games or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes me wonder if there's a way to teach them to teach.
Right.
Which seems like kind of the next step, or that's the reason why humans are so much more advanced than any other animal. I mean, obviously, our brains are bigger and we have sort of the capacity for this, which is where we are in the first place. But I just wonder if there are any sort of less intelligent species that have the same capacity, just maybe at a slightly lower level.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, like you said, the advancement of like passing it on in some sort of physical form, like writing, I think, you know, that creates huge advantages even over language to pass on information. It's basically like your DNA already has tons of information on it that's passed on, from generation to generation. And then there's some things that you can learn from, the other, whatever type of animal that's around you. But to be able to continually transmit a body of knowledge like that, I think is a huge difference.
Right. So that sort of makes me wonder about like species like dolphins or smart, sea-based life forms, where the ability to create these sort of physical artifacts isn't possible because of the sort of erosive nature of the ocean. But it kind of makes me wonder if a dolphin could could learn to like read and write, they're already capable of sort of passing down knowledge.
Right.
Not necessarily through language, but through observed behavior. That was another thing that was in the planet Earth, is there's a particular region where the dolphins have learned how to sort of catch fish by creating sort of dirt rings in the shallow water that forces the fish together into the center. And that's something that no other dolphin species does, or no other dolphins in any other part of the ocean does. It's something this particular group did, and then sort of have been passing it on ever since.
Right.
So there's clearly the ability for certain species, certain intelligent species, to pass on behavior that's not part of their, that's not passed on through like DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it was this other thing where they were talking about dolphins and
Nova Science.
Yeah. Were you going to talk about that, Melanie?
Yeah, but you can.
Well, one part that they did was talking about how they teach them like tricks. The trainers can teach them tricks, and then they have like signs that show, you know, do this trick. They're basically like symbols. But then they taught them a new symbol for like to create something, and then they showed that, and then the dolphins like created a completely different trick by combining, and it was two of them that did it at the same time. So they like went underwater and basically communicated what they were going to do, and then they came back up and did this new trick that they had never done before. Which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really cool. So, but it wasn't so much that they were teaching anything, but they were able to create something new.
Yeah. Yeah, so they weren't just repeating, they were doing it on their own, being creative.
I don't know if you guys have ever seen this video of dolphins blowing air rings. But basically they sort of have they can sort of squirt air out of their mouths into sort of a vortex ring. You know, like when you blow like smoke rings or see uh-huh. someone blow smoke rings. They can do this underwater with air.
Uh-huh.
And it's really interesting to watch them do this because there's no biological sort of imperative for them to have learned this behavior. It's really just them sort of playing. Because you'll see them, like, blow the air out, and then they'll sort of follow it, and they'll sort of, like, stick their nose through it, and then back out, and then, like, they'll sort of, like grab the corner of it, and sort of, like, blow it off into a new direction. It's really, really interesting to watch, and it kind of, like, I think humans are sort of taught, or maybe just infer at a young age that we're sort of this, like, super unique species, which obviously we are, but I feel like sometimes we're taught that we're more sort of important or more unique than we actually are. It's, if you look at some of these other species and their ability to learn and create and play and do all these things that humans do, just sort of at a, maybe at a lower intelligence level, if you want to call it that, it's just really interesting to think about that.
Yeah. The other thing that makes me think of is we've been watching Frozen Planet. Have you been watching that?
No. For some reason, I don't want to get off on a tangent. Go ahead and I'll just leave it at no for now.
Well, there's this one scene in it with killer whales, and they're like incredibly intelligent. And, you know, they hunt together in like really smart ways.
Uh-huh.
Which involve, like, creating waves that will, like, knock an animal off of an iceberg and stuff like that.
Yeah, they all swim in unison, and then through the way that they dive under and create a wave that tips over this piece of ice that a seal is on or something like that.
Huh.
Yeah. But like, not only did they have to figure out that that worked at some point, but also, like, they have to be able to coordinate however many of them there are in order to time it just right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which I guess relies more on communication than necessarily, like, I mean, obviously it's learned behavior, or maybe it's instinctual or something, I don't know. But I guess it relies more on them communicating with each other than anything else.
Well, related to that is they had another one scene where they were... there were some other killer whales who were like chasing penguins up to the ice. And it turns out that like this particular species of killer whale doesn't actually eat penguins. And so they were only doing it to like, to teach the younger whales how to do a certain thing, like where they would swim up to the ice and like come out of the ice to see where the penguins were and stuff like that.
So. Interesting. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't remember what we were talking about.
Well, you started by talking about metaphors,
right? So back to metaphors. There's this sort of like, if we look at it from like a literary standpoint, the reason why people choose metaphors, other than just sort of as a, it's more important than the sort of flowery language part of it, right? It's really the power of the metaphor is that it's very dense in information, right? You're able to sort of transmit this this idea by relating it to something else, and by creating that relationship, you're transmitting with the idea more information than the words themselves carry.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I think I've read at different times that a lot of scientists like poetry, like writing poetry, and that a lot of them are really good at it. And I think it's because of that they're like, so much of scientific understanding science concepts is about like translating that metaphor idea. Like this is being able to say this is like something else, or that kind
of
thing.
Like when that show The Universe does this a lot, but it's always in kind of a goofy way. Like they had this one where this girl, she was like I don't know if she was a scientist or maybe she was a grad student or something studying science.
No, she was a professor somewhere.
Oh, okay. But she's like kind of hip looking and had like dyed hair and like tattoos. Mm-hmm. And when they first showed her, she was talking about something sitting on a rock somewhere talking about it. And then later she was trying to illustrate the concept of, I think it was about, like elliptical, paths of like planets or something, or planets in their.
It was about, it was about objects having a shared, like, center of gravity where they orbit around.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So like the Earth and the Sun actually orbit around a certain point because of their effect of a gravity on each other. And I think that's what it was.
But so later on, they had her, she was like in the dark with like, were they on fire or were they just glowing? Whatever those things were.
They were on fire.
She had these things, these like, what were those things? Do you even know what they were?
I don't remember what it was called that she did. It was like a fire twirler or something.
Yeah, but they were like on rope or something.
Yeah, like these little balls of fire on the.
Like poi. Yeah. I think it's called poi. It's a Japanese thing. Not to be confused with the Hawaiian food.
But it was so funny because, you know, they show her like, you know, sitting in an environment, like on a rock somewhere, talking about this concept. And then in order to like fully illustrate it, they have to like make it dark, light it on fire. And I feel like she was like also exposing her stomach while doing this. Like, I'm not entirely sure.
Yes, well, yes, she was also a belly dancer.
Right. So she's like dancing with fire. Okay. And the whole point was to demonstrate how it was sort of like an elliptical kind of, like, path or whatever that the fire was taking and how it was like going around each other. And but that's what cracks me up about that show, because they explain the concept and a lot of times I'm like, all right, cool, I get it. And then they'll like do something so over the top and ridiculous. But I guess if you didn't understand the concept, they would be helpful. So.
Right.
I don't know.
And that's interesting you bring that up, because I think that that's, one of the weaknesses of the metaphor of the example is that a lot of times it sort of distracts from the concept that you're trying to teach. Or maybe it's like no example is ever perfect. So there's always like, even if the example is like 90% of the way there's always that sort of 10% that's unexplained by it. That has to be either learned from some other example or through some other way of teaching it.
Right.
Yeah. Which happens a lot in sort of the math and science area, which I guess is why they do it on the universe series. Right.
But you know, I do think that it's really true though, that like, I think it's a learned skill to be able, I mean, obviously it is, but to be able to interpret metaphors, it's sort of like when kids reach the age where they understand sarcasm. Like, before they understand sarcasm, they really don't get it. Like, they have to learn to understand what sarcasm is. And, like, before kids understand that when you use a metaphor, you're attaching associations or ideas about one thing to another thing, and you're, like, further illuminating the second thing. Until they've, like, seen that and practiced it and understood how that works, they don't always make the connection between the two. Like, they sometimes just get confused.
Right.
And so, and I really think that, like with the students that I teach, some of them, there is a bigger gap between, like, immediately understanding when you're comparing two things like that. And I think it comes down to, like, critical thinking skills and being able to, like, recognize associations and stuff. So I think like when people are less able to interpret metaphors, it really does affect the way they can learn other things.
All right. Yeah. So yeah, I think you're right about sort of, we're not sort of born knowing, knowing how to interpret the metaphor, or I guess especially to be able to create a metaphor so that somebody else can learn from you. In that way, it kind of makes me wonder how, since since metaphor seems to be such a powerful learning tool, like how humans learn anything at all. Because we're clearly not born that way. It's sort of a, I guess it's the, during the development of our brains, we learn a lot of things probably just through observing behavior.
Right.
But it makes me kind of wonder how the brain learns in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, while it takes, time to be able to understand metaphor and something that abstract, I do think that we build on like small abstractions. So we understand that like, something that is good in one situation will be good in a different situation, even if it's not exactly the same. Or like, we can understand that I know what a real apple is versus like a picture of an apple. Like, I think we pick up on those kinds of abstractions pretty quickly. And then those build into more complex ideas like metaphors and stuff.
So the last thing I wanted to really talk about is sort of, the novelty of people who have like actual new unique ideas. People like Einstein, who came up, who basically, it seems like every time this happens, it sort of revolutionizes, the way society or the way humanity thinks. Like probably, the first humans who created fire or, learned how to harness fire, the first humans who, learned how to practice agriculture. But, It seems like that's a very rare thing. It happens like maybe once or twice in a given generation. And a lot of times it's not as big as those examples that I gave. But as sort of, creative people, do you guys ever feel the sort of pressure to create like actual new unique things?
Yes.
Do you ever worry that it's like almost impossible to create something new?
Yes. I mean, I think most people who write or who study writing or teach writing, it's kind of a given that nothing you create at this point is going to be entirely new.
Right.
I mean, I think people who are doing experimental kinds of writing are often taking something familiar and twisting it in some novel way by changing a form or something like that. Like Josh's novel does that. But what it really, I mean, he could talk about this too, but he's taking a novel that has narrative elements and using a form that is not usually what we consider, like he's using the structure of a podcast, but written. So it's, I don't know, Josh, maybe you can be clearer about it than I can, but it's taking like the familiar idea of a novel with narrative elements, but it's changing the form that it's delivered in.
Yeah. And I think that, like you said, it's just a sort of different variation of something else. Like that's having a novel in a different form isn't new. Like, you know, we have novels in the form of blogs or letters, you know, basically since we've had novels, we've had people doing them in different ways. So,
right.
Yeah, there's that acknowledgement that this isn't necessarily anything totally new.
But it's like, I mean, it's like the guy who wrote the novel without using the letter E. I mean, it's just a matter of different constraints sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so like what that guy did, he chose to do something that, you know, nobody else has done by simply removing a letter from the letters available to him. but then there are other people who would say like, okay, so, but that's just like sort of invention for invention's sake in some ways, you know, like, some people would discount a lot of experimental work just because it seems like you can't write a new story, so you're just trying to write a story in a different way. And some people, I guess, don't always see the point in that. But,
well,
but like, Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, in that particular example, I haven't read this book, so I don't know if it's necessarily, if it has any sort of other merits other than the sort of novelty that you mentioned, where it doesn't have the letter E in it. But I think there's probably some sort of threshold where if you were to take these two ideas of sort of the novelty of something and also the quality of of the thing that it's sort of twisting or changing.
Mm-hmm.
I think if both of those things are relatively high, then it's considered impressive to I guess both parties, the people who are looking for the quality and the people who are looking for the novelty. But if it's sort of one or the other, it will really just appeal to one of those groups. And then obviously if either of those things are low enough, it probably won't appeal to anybody.
Right.
yeah, that's I think that's true.
I mean,
yeah, we talked about, I had a class last semester, we talked about constrained writing, and we read that book, and then we talked about another book, or I guess, I don't know, it's not a book, but it was like supposed to be writing the story without repeating any words, and that was a case where it was like, hey, this is a really cool idea, and then the actual carrying out of that idea turned out to be like, well, no, this isn't very good.
Yeah, I guess if the constraint was too constraining for you to actually write something that was good, or I guess maybe that's what makes like a book that doesn't have the letter E in it, maybe that's impressive because of the constraint. It seems like a almost impossible undertaking, right? E is the most popular letter in the English language, or most used letter, so.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I can't imagine writing anything that's not like a Twitter message that doesn't repeat any words, so.
Right.
Like, in that case, that constraint seems like a little too constraining.
Yeah.
Well, and in that case also, like, it was interesting because you get to see, like, what does that mean when you take the letter E out? And it turns out that actually, like, that affects the types of things you can write. Like, for one, you can't really write past tense in English, because, you know, most of our verbs end in ED when they're in past tense. And so it's going to be in the present tense. And then there are all these other implications that means. Like, it's going to affect the type of novel you can actually write just by changing what letters you allow yourself to use.
So, bringing this back a little bit, I originally started talking about artificial intelligence. The sort of limitations that I'm aware of so far in the field of artificial intelligence is that we're sort of trying to model the physical aspect of the human brain, the sort of neurons that connect together and fire signals off to one another based on the inputs that they have. And so they've even gone so far as to connect like millions of these sort of artificial neurons together. But they haven't really had any satisfactory results as far as having something actually learn. It's really just sort of programming a machine to do something in a slightly more obtuse way than just programming it to do that thing.
Right.
And maybe for certain scenarios, it's way easier to teach it or to write the program in this way. But nobody's really risen above that core problem. But I feel like maybe the problem is that they're really only trying to model the physical aspect of it. They're really only trying to model the brain and not necessarily the ways that humans learn through sort of metaphor and abstraction and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's really just like dumping a whole bunch of inputs into something and then telling it whether or not the outputs are correct, which isn't really how humans learn. I mean, maybe at a really base fundamental level, but when you talk about sort of being cognizant of a concept. Like if somebody was teaching you how to do a certain set of math problems and the only feedback that you got was, no, your answer was wrong, as opposed to, no, your answer was wrong, but this is where you messed it up, we probably wouldn't be very good at learning new things. So.
Right. I watched this hour-long documentary, I guess, called The Science of Babies.
Uh-huh.
And there was a... It had a bunch of different things in it, like that even infants know how to do math, which was really interesting. But one of the it's kind of like these different experiments, I guess. And one of them, this guy was trying to teach. He was trying to figure out how to teach a computer, I think, just language, the way that children learn language.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have any like definitive results or anything. They were just demonstrating sort of what he did in his project or whatever. But he set up like audio and cameras and stuff all throughout his house. And then he filmed his infant for a year or something. And was trying to figure out, I guess he was trying to analyze the way his infant learned the English language so that he could use the specific ways to then teach a computer, uh-huh. I guess. And they didn't say if he was like successful or not, but, but it was just interesting because this kid, well, what I found interesting about it was that this kid, before he was even a year old, was saying grapefruit. And I thought like, that was pretty, that's like a word that babies don't usually say, but I think they were really active in like teaching the kid words though. So like this kid walks into a room and his mom's sitting there eating a grapefruit and he points and says grapefruit. Like, so I don't know. They didn't show if they sat there for hours saying, this is a grapefruit, you know?
Right.
But
that's funny. Because I was listening to something the other day. They were talking about, like facial recognition, well, not facial recognition, like computers, but recognizing facial gestures and then like what those mean, what are people's emotions are, what they're thinking because of that. There was this other guy who studied that, a psychologist, I think. And, when he had a kid, he took like a sabbatical, from his teaching job or research job and basically just like studied all of his kids' facial expressions and recorded them and all this. And I was thinking like, that's apparently the way to go as a scientist. You need to have a kid because it's like, it's a free test subject. You know?
Yeah.
You have 24/7 access to your test subject.
So yeah. We need to figure out what we're going to test on our kid.
Yeah, you don't need anyone to like sign papers or or anything. You just have to make sure that what you're doing isn't like so crazy that CPS gets involved.
I was gonna say you don't want to end up being like Skinner with his Skinner box or whatever that thing was. You know what I'm talking about?
Was that the guy that put his daughter in like an aquarium?
I think so. I can't even actually remember what the experiment was now, but I'm pretty sure it involved putting her in a box.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember what you're talking about.
The unfortunate experiment, Schrodinger's baby. pretty sure that's illegal.
Yeah.
I guess you could be like, well, but officer, we haven't opened the box yet, so we don't know if my child is alive or dead. Technically, he's both.
Yeah.
Yeah. You should watch that documentary. It's on Netflix because it's really interesting. They had this other section where, they were talking about how when babies sort of graduate to learn new postures, so like they go from just lying around to being able to crawl, or they go from crawl, like, or they're able to sit up, to then when they can like start walking and stuff. Apparently, each time they hit one of those milestones, they have to relearn certain concepts about boundaries. So they did this experiment where they had this baby, like, I can't remember like what they started with, but if they had the baby like sitting at a certain, like they would have the baby sit on a ledge, like not a high ledge, but have the baby sit on a ledge and then put something that the baby wanted, like a toy, just out of its reach in front of it. So that the only way to reach for it would be to fall off the table. And I know, this sounds terrible.
This sounds like the one we're going to do, I think.
They would catch the baby if it fell. But yeah, they would put it just out of reach. And so the first time it would do it, it would reach and the baby would fall and they'd have to catch it. But then it would learn, oh, I can't reach something that far away. But then as soon as the baby goes from sitting to standing and like walking, they would have the baby walk to the ledge and put the toy the same distance away on the same ledge, and it would walk right off the ledge again. Because
like
apparently
just
when it
fall.
Yeah, it would just walk right. It would like reach for the toy, even though the distance of the from the baby to the toy hadn't changed, but their posture had changed. So they had to relearn that they couldn't reach that far away without falling. So apparently, when your baby goes from like crawling to walking, if they knew that they shouldn't crawl right off the table, apparently they don't know that they should not walk right off the table.
So when they start going through those changes, it's a good time to keep an extra eye on them.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's the point.
Or don't put your baby on any tables.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've all got different strategies, Kyle.
Right. Like ramps up to the table. Yeah. And then just like a foam pad on the floor.
But it just goes back to the point that like you would assume that the baby's understanding of distance wouldn't change just because they're standing versus sitting or whatever. So like, even though they learn something in one context, they don't necessarily maintain the same information in another context. So babies aren't as smart as we thought, is what I'm saying.
So you're saying they don't actually know math?
Well, the math thing was different. They actually do know math.
And they can also say grapefruit, but
yeah, they don't really know. Do you want me to tell you real quickly what the experiment was?
Sure.
Okay, so the math experiment was they had a, I want to say they had like a 6 month old, and then they had like a 1 year old to see if there was any difference, and so they put the baby in front of like what looks like a puppet show. Stage thing, you know, those like real small ones you set on like a table. You know what I'm talking about? Like a little, it looks like a little box,
I think,
that like hides your hand or whatever.
Now I don't know.
Okay. Well, that's a bad comparison. Basically what they had was, they had like a curtain, and behind that curtain, there was like a small stage that you could set on a table. And the stage had like a door on the right side of the stage, a door on the left side of the stage, and a door in the back in the center of the stage. And, they would put like a stuffed animal on the stage. And then they would show a hand reaching in through the left door with a second stuffed animal. And, and there was also like a little flap that you could pull up that covered the center of the stage, but it left the sides of the stage exposed. Uh-huh. So they would have the flap down, they would show a stuffed animal, and then they'd put the flap up, and then they would show a hand coming in from the left and putting another stuffed animal behind the flap. And then when they pulled the flap down, there were two stuffed animals there.
Right.
And so so usually when they did this experiment, the baby would like look at it and then look away, like it wasn't interested. But then, because they had the back door that the flap covered, sometimes they would put a stuffed animal there and then they would show a second stuffed animal coming in on the left side of the stage. But while the flap was still covering the front of the stage, they would remove one of the stuffed animals through the back. So there was still only one stuffed animal there. And when they lowered the flap, the baby would get like really agitated because it knew there was supposed to be two there.
Right.
So they did like a bunch of other experiments sort of using like, you know, the baby is observing something and then they have expected results, but sometimes right. The results were different.
So I guess the sort of core concept there is the idea of object permanence, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's a certain age that babies learn that objects, like, continue to exist even though they can't observe them.
Right, right.
Which I guess is kind of a pretty important concept when learning math or when understanding math.
Yeah.
Right? Because
yeah.
A lot of... Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that math deals with a lot of, like, abstract concepts, things that you can't see or touch. But you sort of have to intuit in some way. So you have to sort of keep track of those things in your head, so...
Right.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's a pretty complicated one, too, it seems like. to be able to understand that, you know, objects are where they were before.
Well, and, like, sometimes they would add a stuffed animal through the back. And so they would add one from the side, and they would add one from the back. And the baby was only expecting two to be there, and then there were three there. And so that also bothered them.
They should have done something with, like, different stuffed animals where they, like, put one in through the side and then took right. that one out through the back and put a different one there. Which I guess wouldn't have taught any sort of mathematical concepts.
Right.
But I would just like to see what the baby thought.
Yeah. I just thought it was interesting because these are babies that can't even talk, you know, but they can tell... They can at least understand that much.
Right. I guess that means that the sort of a fundamental part of learning isn't necessarily being able to communicate, but being able to observe things and to remember those things, at least for a short duration.
Right.
Yeah. Have we talked about theory of mind on the podcast before?
I don't think so. I'm going to say no.
I've talked to different people about it, but it's basically the concept that people have different knowledge, and so we don't all know the same things. And it's something that actually you learn, I think, when you're around like 4 or 5 years old. And so I saw them doing some experiments with this where they had one of the things where they had a kid who had like a bag of M&Ms, and they were like, "What's in the bag?" And he was like, "It's candy." And so they're like, "Oh, let's see." And so they opened the bag of M&Ms and it's got like pencils in it. And the kid's like, "What? That's weird." And then so when they like put the pencils back in, they leave the candy there, and then they're like, they ask him, you know, "If your dad comes in, what is he gonna think is in the bag?" And they're like, "Pencils," because they now know there are pencils in the bag, so they assume everyone else knows that there are pencils in the bag. Or the other example, they had like a kid watching like a video where these two girls are playing with their toys, and then one girl's playing with a doll and the other girl's playing with something else. And the one girl playing with the doll leaves. And then the other girl goes over, takes the doll and hides it under a basket. And so then they ask the kid who's watching, like, "When she comes back in, where's she going to look for the doll?" And they're like, "She's going to look under the basket, 'cause that's where it is."
Right. But
then like after like, I think 4 or 5, maybe it's 5, they know it's like, well, they don't know the same thing I know anymore, so I don't know why that happens. But
huh. Yeah, it's interesting, I guess, the sort of universal stages of development that that humans go through on their way to becoming a real person.
My favorite thing that kids don't understand when they're little is pronouns. Like, they don't understand, like, because, you know, your parents ask you all kinds of questions when you're a baby, or they offer you things, and they say, like, you know, "Do you want this?" Or, you know, whatever. And, like, when kids are little, they don't understand that "you" means something different than yourself. Like, they internalize "you" to mean "me." So, rather than being abstract, the example I like is about you, actually. Mom has told me this before, that when you were little, she would ask you, do you want mommy to hold you? And then sometimes if you wanted to be held, you would say, mommy, hold you. And I think that's like the cutest thing ever. So I can't wait for our little kid to not understand pronouns yet.
Or like, what was the grilled cheeses story?
Oh yeah. I was at Starbucks, several months ago, and there was this guy and two boys. I assumed he was their dad. And the kid was like, he looked like he was like, I don't know, 8 to 10, somewhere in there. And then the kid said to his dad, I want grilled cheeses. And the dad was like, you mean a grilled cheese sandwich? And he was like, I want grilled cheeses. And he was like, and the dad was like trying so hard to understand. He was like, wait, do you want multiple grilled cheese sandwiches, or do you want like one grilled cheese sandwich with multiple kinds of cheese on it? And the kid just kept saying, I want grilled cheeses. And he said it several times, and the dad was getting so frustrated. And he was like, finally the dad said, no, I need you to tell me you understand that one of that's plural. So that means you want many of something. And the kid just like never budged. He just kept saying, I want grilled cheeses.
Okay, we've probably talked way too long about this, and I'm not even sure if any of it's usable, so let's take a quick break so I can stop this so that we don't lose any of it, and then we will continue later. So you've been listening to Taekwondo, The Shame Chronicles. We'll be right back.